Hi, I'm Bruno Lafou, and this is number 0176 of the Stuff Fire program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is once again the Stuff File program, number 0176. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet David Duchemin, who is a globetrotting photographer and the author of The Print and the Process, taking compelling photographs from vision to expression. He is described as a world and humanitarian photographer. What exactly does that mean?
Most of my year is spent traveling the world and photographing either landscapes or culture. And then over the last 8 years, my primary assignment work in terms of working for clients has been working with the international NGO and development community. So humanitarian groups like World Vision or Save the Children have been my primary clients. And so, you know, the word humanitarian sort of continues to kind of creep up when people describe my work.
We also have a retro interview with a star who's no longer with us. This time it's a chat with actor Jack Klugman, who died on Christmas Eve. He talked about his career and also what's known as the golden age of television.
When you think of the people that came out of Barry Chayefsky's and that came out of the writers, that came out of the directors, that came out, and the actors that came out of live television in the 50s and 60s and almost the 70s. They were wonderful times.
We have another review. Stuart Nullman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman. On this edition of Book Banter, we join the End of Your Life Book Club, along with some personal recommendations of the books that were selected by this select book club. It's all coming up later on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0176, was artist Bruno Lafou. And you can check out his YouTube page. The link will be found on this week's Stuff File What's On page on the website at thestufffile.com. And thank you once again, Bruno, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. The Stuff File program is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, Amanda Miller returned to her home in Uniontown, Pennsylvania, and says she found Myron Rose, age 33, running from the house carrying her children's Christmas presents in a large bag. She was able to identify him since he's her ex-boyfriend and the father of two of her three kids. Police caught up with Rose and found the bag with the presents still inside. He was arrested and charged with burglary and held on $50,000 bail. Investigators determined Rose got into Miller's mobile home by cutting a hole in the floor and climbing up inside. What kind of person would make a hole in the floor and break into a house and steal his own kids' Christmas presents? Asked Miller's grandmother. Well, you know, come in through the floor to steal Christmas presents? Sounds like the work of Anti-Claus. Yes. Anyway. Here's one case of bad parental examples. Besides the one we just heard, of course. A Belfair, Washington man had a 15-point plan for his wife. He allegedly told friends, the first point, give her a special cigarette. But she began freaking out, and that, she told police, was when he told her what was special about the cigarette. It contained methamphetamine. He said he wanted her to experience the kind of high he enjoyed, so she'd understand, the police report said. Ultimately, he allegedly wanted her to become an addict. The wife, age 22, went to the hospital. The husband, age 20, went to jail. Their two kids went with a family friend. And what's his plan to help them understand their father is what I want to know. Although I think they've got a pretty good idea already. Elsewhere, sheriff's deputies in Fountain Hills, Arizona, say they knew that Mark Dirksen, age 63, was a drug dealer, but it took them 2 years to get enough evidence to arrest him. They say he gave away free samples of meth to get people hooked so that he could sell them more. When they raided his apartment with a search warrant, deputies found large amounts of heroin, meth, and other drugs, as well as guns. Dirksen allegedly admitted to investigators he sold drugs to people to bring them closer to God. You see, he's a pastor at Faith Mountain Christian Church. Yeah. I'm pretty sure that's not what angels we have heard on high actually means. But then, you know, what do I know? I only spent a lifetime in church as a child. According to testimony in Perth, Australia, in November, one retired priest, Thomas Byrne, age 80, bit off the ear of another, Thomas Smith, age 81, in a brawl over a parking space. Father Byrne and Father Smith are residents of the same retirement home in the Perth suburb of Daniela. Gee, I guess when you retire, you really leave the job behind, don't you? Wow. And here's a rookie mistake. Joseph O'Callaghan, age 31, was sentenced to 9 years in prison by a court in Belfast, Northern Ireland, in November for having robbed an armored car guard in 2011. He had made off with the guard's cash box, but since he had accosted the guard on his way into Northern Bank and not on his way out of Northern Bank, the box was empty. Yeah. This is why teachers always say, you know, do your homework. Do your homework. Yes. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Heather Hodges, age 26, had a rocky relationship with her unnamed boyfriend's 13-year-old son. Finally, she said she had enough and took action. Police allege that Hodges secretly went through the boy's backpack, removing his deodorant and cologne, and replacing them with an unloaded pistol. She then sent him to class at Magnolia Junior High School in Houston, Texas. Surveillance video shows Hodges pulling up to a convenience store payphone and placing an anonymous call to the school, warning them about the gun and naming her boyfriend's son, who was later detained. Her explanation to me was that she wanted to see my son get into trouble, said the boy's father. Once the video was reviewed, the boy was exonerated, and Hodges was arrested and charged with unlawfully carrying a weapon on restricted premises and unlawfully transferring a handgun to someone under 18. That's hard to get past, said Hodges' now ex-boyfriend. It's hard to look at it and say, okay, I forgive you. Oh, you made a mistake. That's a huge mistake to make. You figure? Yeah, that was no mistake. That was just another case of obliviousy in action. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? David Duchemin is a globetrotting photographer and author. His latest book is The Print and the Process, taking compelling photographs from vision to expression. He is also the mind behind Photograph, a digital quarterly magazine for creative photographers. And David joins us on the line right now from Vancouver. Hi, David.
Hey, how are you, Peter?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for the invitation.
Looking at your bio material, you're listed as a world and humanitarian photographer. What exactly does that mean?
Well, that's a good question. You know, at a certain point when you're online, you have to kind of give yourself a label, and at a certain point, you then kick against that label. But most of my year is spent traveling the world and photographing either landscapes or culture. And then over the last 8 years, my primary assignment work in terms of working for clients has been working with the international NGO and development community. So humanitarian groups like World Vision or Save the Children have been my primary clients, and so, you know, the word humanitarian sort of continues to kind of creep up when people describe my work.
So doing that kind of photography, how has it affected or changed you?
Oh, wow. You know, we could probably talk for hours about that. The best way I can describe it, I used to come back from these trips and, you know, of course, you'd come into Vancouver from wherever, and the folks at Customs would ask where I was coming from, and then they would ask why, and I would tell them, and they used to say, you know, that must be so hard, because, you know, Peter, I mean, I primarily work with children and families and you know, people that feel the hit of poverty, probably, you know, the hardest. And they would all say, always say, oh, that must be so hard. And I would say, you know, honestly, the hardest part is coming home, because when you work and move among the poor, and I don't of course want to romanticize anything, but my experience in the majority world has always been that I leave feeling that they have given me so much more than I could ever give to them. There's always a kindness and a hospitality there that that always leaves me, you know, I come home and people don't look each other in the eye as much, and everyone's kind of wearing the same, you know, same black jackets and same dark jeans, and coming from a place, you know, any spot in Southeast Asia or Africa where people are dressed colorfully and they look you in the eye and they're so concerned about relationship and each other, you can't help but come home and feel a little bit like we've lost something. That, you know, while we look at these majority world cultures and say, yes, there's poverty there, we too have sort of experienced an impoverishment in terms of losing the relationality in our culture. And when you're living with such poverty, there are no substitutes. You know, they don't have the big screen TVs and the things that preoccupy them. All they have is each other. And I think coming back to Canada after those experiences reminds me of that. I hesitate to call it a loss, but, you know, we certainly have made some choices in our culture at times. And I long for that vibrancy of life that you get in, you know, in those other places that I visit.
Sometimes when you go someplace, be it a positive trip or a negative trip, or just wherever you go, there's a sensory overload in what you take in. But you, as a photographer, once you come back from wherever you've been, you then get to go through all of these pictures you've taken. What goes through your mind as you look back at where you've been when you get home with these pictures?
That's an interesting question. I think because when I sit down after having, you know, done my work on the field, I sit down and I think I looked at it with certainly not with an objective eye, but with a very technical eye. And so it's a little bit less where I'm hit emotionally and sort of at the core of my being is even before I raise the camera to my eye. And once I start taking the photographs, you know, that can be actually quite a very difficult process. But the actual sitting and looking at the photographs when I get home, I think there's a little bit of a separation in terms of the emotional experience. When I'm looking at the photographs, I'm looking for lines and light and moments and things that are concerned with the, you know, within the frame of an actual photograph. The experience of it a little bit gets put on the shelf. But when I, of course, later when I look at those final selects and I'm experiencing it with a cup of coffee and kind of taking a break, that I think is when the memories come back. And I have photographs on my walls from, you know, the last couple of years from trips that I still look at and feel that emotional pull that I felt when, you know, before I raised the camera and you look at something and say, you know, oh my gosh, look at that. That, I think, for most photographers is the thing that makes us put the camera to our eye, and that's why we make the photograph. So that feeling, I don't think, ever really goes away.
Now, let's talk a little bit about your book, because, again, the book is called The Print on the Process, Taking Compelling Photographs from Vision to Expression. When you put this book together, who were you thinking of most of all? Someone who has some experience with a camera, or someone who's picking it up for the first time?
No, this is definitely for someone who's had some experience with a camera, who knows, you know, as my manager says, knows an f-stop from a bus stop. But it's really a bit of a reaction to, you know, a lot of the camera companies, they promote this idea that, you know, hey, if you get this latest camera, you'll shoot like a pro, whatever shoot like a pro means. And from my experience, shoot like a pro means you show up at a place, you experience a place, and then you have this struggle and the process of trying to put that experience, that multidimensional experience, into a very limited medium, into that sort of small still frame of a photograph. And so the book really is designed to talk through the creative process of photography for people that have picked it up. Now, if you've got a point-and-shoot camera and all you leave it on is program mode and you never do anything but raise it to your eye and press the button, that's okay, too. I think, you know, that there are certainly aesthetic choices that you've allowed yourself not to be concerned with. But in terms of experiencing a place and how do you make the best possible photograph, the photograph that best expresses what you feel or think about a place, then those concerns are certainly discussed in the book. But I think the person that will get the most out of it is someone that's a little bit more familiar with their camera.
And I guess it's a situation, are you a person who's going out with a camera because you're going someplace and you have one, therefore you're taking pictures, or are you going out with your camera to take pictures?
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of that distinction. But, I mean, for someone like myself, it's always a little of both. You know, I will go to a place like, you know, like Venice, which is one of the projects I covered in the book. And there were times when I was in Venice already, and yes, I had my camera, but I was just out to have dinner and to have an experience. And yet, suddenly I see something completely unexpected and think, oh my gosh, look at that. And of course, in those situations, one of two things happens. Inevitably, I reach for my camera and I haven't got it because I've left it in the room. Or I end up making one of these unexpected photographs that becomes one of my favorites, you know, for years to come. And so I certainly think there are people that will travel and just kind of have a camera anyway. But we still end up making these amazing photographs because life happens unexpectedly, and photography is, if anything, you know, it's about these unexpected moments in life. So I think it's kind of for both kind of people.
How has the internet changed photography as far as you're concerned?
You know, the internet is, I don't think I'm overstating it when I say it's kind of a little bit like the revolution that occurred when the printing press came out. All of a sudden, there was the ability for people, admittedly a small group of people, but the ability of people, suddenly the gatekeepers weren't there. In the case of Gutenberg, you know, suddenly it was a freedom from the organized church, and suddenly there was the, you know, we have the Reformation because the printing press was there. Here, nowadays with the internet, artists especially, but anyone that has a thought or an idea has the ability to publish that. With, I wanted to publish something that was maybe not a full book, but I wanted to get it out to my readers, and I had a growing community. And I published this ebook, and without any gatekeepers, without approaching a publisher, without approaching anyone and saying, hey, can I build it? I just built it and put it online. And before I knew it, people were consuming it. And now I've got, you know, I mean, now I'm a publisher. Now I am the guy that's going to people and saying, hey, would you love to write an ebook for us? But you can come home as a photographer from a trip, and instead of just, you know, printing your work and finding a way to print it, you can literally be, I was on a plane at one point coming home from Ethiopia, and I was like over Greenland, and the Lufthansa service had wireless, and I was publishing my photographs to the net for, you know, for thousands of people to look at, and I wasn't even home yet. And so the ability to share, I mean, at the core of everything that most artists do is this desire to share it with the world and you know, sort of to create something that is a gift to more people than just ourselves. And so the internet's given us a way to do that largely for free without any of the gatekeepers. It's an astonishing development for people that want to create something and share it.
The book is called The Print and the Process, Taking Compelling Photographs from Vision to Expression, and it's just out. But I just want to ask very quickly, about a minute, digital quarterly that I alluded to in the introduction, Photograph, a digital quarterly magazine for creative photographers, how does one go about getting that?
You can get that on the website at craftandvision.com.
Craftandvision.com.
That's right.
Excellent. Thank you very, very much, David, for taking the time to talk with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Peter.
Photographer David Duschenman, author of The Print and the Process, Taking Compelling Photographs from Vision to Expression. You can check out his website at daviddusheman.com. You can also find his online magazine for photographers at craftandvision.com. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0176, and you'll find links to his sites. You'll also find links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Informed or entertained? Hey, you're doing both. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we will have a retro interview with a celebrity no longer with us, the recently departed Jack Klugman. We'll hear that. Plus, Stuart Nullman is back with another edition of Book Banter, and of course, there is an idiot of the day. On a program heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right back to the stuff. Pennsylvania State Police say they have arrested a man accused of breaking into his ex-girlfriend's home and using glue on her refrigerator and computer. Police said Dennis Holmberg, age 42, of Elizabethville, entered his ex-girlfriend's apartment when she was away on November 12th and glued shut the refrigerator door and a utensil drawer and poured glue on the woman's computer keyboard. The Harrisburg Patriot News reported Monday that Holmberg was charged with burglary, criminal trespass, stalking, and criminal mischief. Yes, you should lock him up, but, you know, points for creativity. That's all I'm saying. In British Columbia, police in BC said they have received a flood of 911 calls from motorists angry about being stuck in Boxing Day traffic. Staff Sergeant Robert Marks of the Burnaby BC RCMP said that there were so many 911 calls from drivers upset about the traffic on the traditional shopping and gift returning holiday that authorities lost count. Obviously, people on Boxing Day are out returning things and doing their shopping. It's the traffic and people not being able to exit parking lots at the mall that's causing this. So it's kind of an unusual call to get as far as 911 calls are concerned, Mark said. Burnaby RCMP Staff Sergeant Steve Crawford posted a request on the department's official Twitter account for drivers to stop calling 911 to complain about the traffic. You can imagine that when you do receive those 911 calls, they tie up the lines and prevent people from what could be legitimate 911 calls, Mark said. There's only a limited number of lines. Oh, the trials and tribulations of living in the first world, huh? Yeah. And a Sioux Falls, South Dakota man was arrested on Christmas after an alleged dispute over a board game. Police said they responded to a report of a domestic dispute at 3:45 p.m. Lieutenant Blaine Larson said the suspect and his father were arguing over the game. Larson didn't know what type of game they were playing. Larson said 33-year-old Benjamin Walter bit and clamped down on the forearm of an officer before he was taken into custody. The officer suffered minor injuries. Walter was charged with aggravated assault on law enforcement and simple assault domestic. You know, I guess all that Christmas goodwill really bites the dust early. Or in this case, just plain bites. A Barrow County Sheriff's deputy encountered a burglary case that's possibly more suited to a ghost hunter. Though she perhaps should have called Ghostbusters. The theft victim instead told local deputies that a ghost stole from her. The 40-year-old Winder, Georgia woman reported that her resume was stolen, a criminal history, and a blouse sometime during the past 2 weeks. According to a Barrow County Sheriff's report, When the deputy asked the woman if she knew anyone who might have taken the items, she said a ghost or a spirit, because the ghost of her mother often visits. However, she told the deputy she also occasionally sees a black spirit roaming near her home. Gosh, even when they're dead, they want to blame it on black people. Yikes. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next interview here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, police in Florida said two sisters were arrested after inadvertently pocket-dialing the hotel they had allegedly just robbed. Naples police said a woman wearing sunglasses and a black bandana covering her mouth entered the In Place Hotel on November 18th and put her hands in her pockets, indicating the presence of a weapon. The woman demanded money from the register and fled with an unspecified amount of cash. Investigators said the phone rang while the clerk was waiting for police to arrive, and the clerk discovered it was an accidental pocket dial. Police said the clerk recognized the voices of the suspect and Ashley Allowine, age 22, a former employee who had been fired 2 days before the robbery. Police said the women discussed the robbery while the clerk listened in on their conversation. Officers spoke with Shelby Allowine, the owner of the cell phone number used to make the hotel call, and she told police that she sometimes shares the phone with daughters Ashley Allowine and Nakila Wright, age 18. Police said Wright was identified as the woman who robbed the hotel. Both suspects were arrested and charged with robbery and petty theft. You know, these two were almost candidates for Idiot of the Day, but they weren't. That comes later, though. But I warn you, when it does get here, this week's idiot does involve a cell phone. That's all I'm saying. Anyway, right now, let's take a moment to properly say goodbye to a star.
This is the Stuff File.
It's time for another retro interview with a celebrity that is no longer with us. This time, it's a chat I had back in September of 2007, and it's with someone who just recently left us. This was a fine, talented star who had a long career as a dramatic stage and film actor. But it was his role as Oscar Madison in the 70s sitcom The Odd Couple that first brought him a legion of new fans, and where he found a best friend for life in co-star Tony Randall. Jack Klugman embodied the role of Oscar, so much so that this dramatic actor, who had to convince people he could do comedy, would later have to convince others after The Odd Couple that he could once again do drama, which he accomplished by going on to star as the medical examiner in the hit series Quincy. Jack was diagnosed with throat cancer in 1974 and had vocal surgery in 1989, in which part of his larynx was removed. It was his friendship with Tony Randall that got him through it, and it was Tony who got him back to work. After Randall's death in 2004, Jack wrote a loving tribute to his friendship with Tony called Tony and Me. It was for the publication of that book that I had a chance to talk to Jack Klugman. Here is part of that conversation now.
Would you like to know?
Well, let's start off with the fact that you've written this book, Tony and Me, and of course it deals with your longtime friendship with your co-star, Tony Randall, who was very instrumental in helping you, especially when you went through your crisis with cancer a few years ago. But what I'd like to know is, how well did you know Tony before you started The Odd Couple?
Well, I knew about his work. I saw him on Mr. Peepers, and I knew he was terrific. And in 1954, we did a show together, a terrible show called Appointment with Adventure, and it was terrible. But I got to know him, and then I didn't see him again until 1971, from 1954 to 1971, but I knew about his work. I knew what a wonderful actor he was.
Now, you worked together on The Odd Couple, and as I mentioned, you had that situation where you ended up with larynx cancer, cancer?
I lost my right vocal cord, was taken out, and so it's now a stump. So I had to educate the left cord to come beyond where it usually goes and hit it for sound. It does not hurt me to talk. I say that in my one-man show. It does not hurt me to talk. In fact, it's a privilege to be able to talk.
But When that took place and that happened to you, you must have thought, well, that's the end. That I'm not going to be able to work. And I think that's where Tony really came in.
Well, Tony was one of the first people to come to the hospital when I was in there. And I was very angry. I said, I lost my voice. He said, well, let's face it, Jack, you never did sound like Richard Burton anyway. And then he said, but before he left, he said, if and when you're ready to come back, we'll find a venue for you. And yeah, you'll find a venue for an actor without a voice. But he did. He brought me back to Broadway. We did one performance of the Odd Couple. He raised $1,250,000. And that was the best evening of my life, the greatest evening of my life. It didn't turn out, it started badly, but it turned out to be a beautiful evening. And his support was so wonderful. The book is called Tony and Me, A Story of Friendship. If you have a friend like Tony, as close as we were, you must tell that person. You've got to appreciate the friendship. It's a very important. I knew how much I loved him and how important he was in my life. But when he died, I realized then that I hadn't told him how much he meant, because I didn't know how much he meant to me.
Mm-hmm.
But he was in New York. He was in the hospital. And I went to New York and I substituted for him. American Cancer Society gave him the award. I accepted it for him. And I visited him every day in the hospital. And I told him then how important he was in my life. And we talked. But when he died, that's when it really hit me. I couldn't imagine a world without Tony Randall.
Were the two of you really like Oscar and Felix?
I was. He wasn't. I was really sloppy. I love women. I gambled a lot. I did everything that Oscar did. And I tried to live a carefree life. That's what Oscar tried to live. He wanted to be free of cares. It's the best way to live if you have to live. And that's what he tried to do. But when Tony came in, he was the best Felix that ever was. There'll never be another Felix like him. Because he wouldn't tell you to be neat because he wanted you to be neat. He would tell you to be neat because it would better your life. So it was all outgoing. And he was really wonderful that way. You know, we were never a hit, except until we went into syndication. We were like in the top, we were never in the top 40. We were 52nd, 62nd, and then we got canceled every year because they couldn't find us. But the audience laughed so hard, and Tony would get frustrated. Why can't we make? I said, Tony, they haven't found us. When we go into syndication, I said, I replaced Walter Matthau on Broadway, and I didn't get the laughs I'm getting when we're working. I said, so trust me, and it's what happened. But it was good because Paramount thought there was a flop, so they gave us a piece of a real piece, and that piece sent my kids to the college.
Now, I think there's something that's rather unique about your career on television, and that is you went from one big hit show, although you said it wasn't a massive hit, but still, it was on for years, and we all saw it in syndication. We all grew up watching it. You went from one hit show right into another, but the thing that is different about your career, because a lot of people have done back-to-back hit shows, but you went from a comedy to a drama when you starred as Quincy.
Well, first, before I did Odd Couple, they said to Tony, he can't do comedy. He's a serious actor. And then afterwards, when I did, they said, he can't do drama. He can only do comedy. They try to pigeonhole you. They try to typecast you. When I did that show, I said, I got a lot of interviews for comedies. And I said, no, I don't want to do it. I did the best situation comedy I could do. I worked with the best actor. No, I want to do a drama. So when they sent me Quincy, I knew this guy could be a muckraker, which is I always wanted to be like Upton Sinclair. So, but one of the guys who offered me a job as in a comedy, when he heard that I did this, he called my agent and said, Jack turns me down, and now he's playing a Undertaker. They didn't even know what it was. They didn't know what it was. And he was in those days.
medical examiner. Yeah. Was it difficult for you to wrap your tongue around some of that medical jargon that you had to do in that show?
Well, I always feel if you're a butcher, you have to chop beef and beef and lamb and pork, and that's what you have to do as an actor. I would go up sometimes, but I got used to it. We had a wonderful expert, a doctor on the set, and I had questions, and I would ask him questions, and he would answer me, and I would say, how do you pronounce this? And he would tell me, I said, what is it? I always wanted to know what it was. And the thing today, they sort of go with the gory stuff. We never had a body on the table when we did an autopsy, because we wanted, everything we did was for the living, not for the dead. If I found out who the murderer was of somebody, then that murderer was taken off the street. If there was an epidemic, we did an autopsy, we found out what the cause of the epidemic was, and that stopped that. So we always did it for the living. Today, they're interested in gory details. They open, they show you the blood and the guts and everything. I don't like it today.
Mm. One of the things, you have a lot in your career to be proud of, the television shows, the films, but I want to go back really early for a few moments, and that is 12 Angry Men.
Oh. That was the only picture I really enjoyed making, because everybody was there every day, and you couldn't get that much talent into a room today. I mean, they were the best actors. They were, Sidney Lumet directed it. He was the best director that I had worked with up to that time. He was wonderful. The actors were wonderful. The script was good. It was wonderful. Italy Cobb. I'd seen him in Death of a Salesman 5 times for $1.80 each time. Today it's $100. And he was better than magnificent. He was just sensational. And then E.G. Marshall and Archo Sweeney, all the Jack Warden, Johnny Fito, all friends of mine.
It must have been the closest you can get on film to kind of doing a play.
Yes. Well, it was a play, really. In fact, they did it, as you know, they did it as a play. And they didn't change any of the lines. And I was doing Lee Cobb's part. Bobby Lewis was directing. And it's when I found out I had cancer in the larynx. So a week before we would open, I found out I had it, so I wasn't able to do it. But it's a wonderful play. And Reggie Rose told me, the guy who wrote it, that he made more money from that play as 12 Angry Women at these PTA meetings than he did as a movie.
You worked for a long time with Tony, and
a lot of other plays. We did Sunshine Boys.
You did the Sunshine Boys, right?
Yeah, we did Three Men on a Horse. We did a lot of plays, and we did down in Florida. We did plays. Tony Randall was my favorite. He was just unbelievable. He was a better actor than anybody ever gave him credit for. You had to be on stage with him to see how good he really was.
And he did have a love for the arts, a love for the theater, and did a lot to champion theater in New York.
Oh, yes. He put $8 million of his own money into his theater. And they treated him very badly, the press. But they dimmed the lights when he died, and I thought that was a respectful thing to do. He loved the theater. He had kids come from high schools to see his plays. Cost him $35,000 a week. But he said, no, I want him to see good plays presented well. He did some of the best plays I've seen.
Was it a cathartic experience for you to write the book, Tony and Me?
Yes. It's a tribute to Tony. I published it myself because I didn't want anybody to tell me, you can't do this, you must write it this way. I had to get it out to tell him how much I loved him and how much he meant to my life. He brought me back to the theater, which I love so much. Without him, I wouldn't have come back. And he was very important in my life. So this was a tribute to him.
And after all these years working in television and working in film and now on stage, you still, which is great to hear, you still keep busy.
Oh, yeah. I'm 85 years old and I keep busy. But I want to tell you, they were the golden years. When you think of the people that came out of Barry Chayefsky's and that came out of the writers, that came out of the directors, that came out, and the actors that came out of live television in the 50s and 60s and almost the 70s. They were wonderful times.
Yeah, you talk about that time and the golden age of New York theater and back in those 50s and those days. Did you have a chance to really appreciate it at the time while you were going through it, or do you only realize how good it was looking back at it?
Well, how I appreciated it when it was there. I had no agent. I did 450 live television shows, and I had no agent. In fact, MCA hired, they said, we want to represent you because you're working too much. And they would call you at home. It was very personal. And those people, Johnny Frankenheimer, Sidney Lumet, Marty Ritt, Arthur Penn, all these wonderful directors came out of live television. Then they came out of the 50s and 60s and 70s. And Bob Mulligan, the best director I ever worked for, he came out of it too.
Has there been anything in your career, just got about a minute, has there been anything in your career that you haven't had a chance to do that you wanted to do?
No, because nobody hires me for movies now. So I did Death of a Salesman, I did The Price, I did not Rappaport. I'm doing plays now, and I love them. They freed me. I am free. I'm going to die with absolutely nothing in my closets. My doors will be open. I've had a wonderful life, a wonderful career. I mean, I've just had the best. I worked with the best. Henry Fonda, James Mason, Humphrey Bogart, Larbaca, the best. So I've had a wonderful life, and they were Ethel Merman, and they were all wonderful.
Well, one of the reasons why you work with the best is because you yourself are one of the best, and I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the show with us this evening.
My pleasure.
That was part of an interview with actor Jack Klugman. Jack died on Christmas Eve, December 24th, 2012, at the age of 90. He will be missed. But his finest work can still be seen in syndication and on DVDs. And now Jack can be with his best friend once again. The Odd Couple are back together.
The Stuff File. I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. One of the most popular gifts this holiday season was an e-reader. The tablets, which can hold hundreds of books, are becoming so popular that some libraries have even started providing them to the public. In California, the Sacramento Library used a federal grant to purchase e-readers. Unfortunately, soon after the program began, a lawsuit threatened to end it. Even though the e-readers were bought with federal funds, the U.S. Department of Justice sued the library because the devices could not be used by the blind. Let's be fair, only in America would the federal government sue a library for using federal funds as designed. Now, a settlement to the lawsuit has forced the library to spend thousands of dollars to buy new devices that can read the books aloud, at the same time that budget cuts are forcing it to put employees on unpaid furloughs. Other libraries have now put plans for similar programs on hold. Learn more about how excessive litigation limits consumer choices. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And once again, surviving the Mayans, here he is, Stuart Nauman.
Hi, Peter. And also wishing you a Happy New Year, too.
Happy New Year to you, too.
Well, thank you. And, you know, on this edition of Book Banter, one of my favorite books of this past year, 2012, is a book dealing with book clubs.
A book dealing with book clubs.
Yeah, not book clubs in general, but there's a certain particular book club.
Is that kind of like Kramer's coffee table book on coffee tables?
Well, sort of, but there's no fold-out legs on the bottom of this book.
Okay.
No. See, I was involved with a book club for many, many years, actually, for about close to 7-8 years, actually.
No, really?
Yeah.
You in a book club?
Yeah, I moderated one. My sister organized it, and We met once a month and discussed, you know, books that we chose, you know, very interesting books of different types and genres.
Who would have thought of you in a book club? I'm blown over now.
Yeah. Well, what are the chances, huh?
What are the odds?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it was great, you know, talk about great books and, you know, over some wine, some cake, some coffee. It was some good nosh and good reading, actually. Now, basically, these book club discussions were a stimulating night out, gave us a fine appreciation of books, whether it was a novel, a memoir, or even a murder mystery. But what if a book club was formed as a means of intellectual stimulation and solace in the face of battling a deadly disease? And that's the premise of Will Schwab's extraordinary memoir of book appreciation called The End of Your Life Book Club. Now, Schwab, who he runs a cooking website and was once the editor-in-chief of Hyperion Books, formed his intimate book club with his mother, Mary Ann Schwab, in 2007 after she was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer following a trip to Afghanistan and Pakistan on behalf of the International Rescue Committee, a humanitarian organization that she was passionately involved with. Now, most of the meetings between mother and son took place at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City, where she was undergoing chemotherapy treatments. Now, a selection of books that they read and discussed together during the two-year period as chronicled in this book reflects the diverse tastes of the type of books both mother and son like to read. It included John O'Hara's 1934 novel Appointment in Samarra, Herman Wouk's epic bestseller Marjorie Morningstar, The Hobbit, Joan Didion's memoir of personal tragedy, The Year of Magical Thinking, Irene Nemirovsky's novel of life in Nazi-occupied France called Suite Française, Mariatu Camara's memoir of life in war-torn Sierra Leone called The Bite of the Mango, and Daily Strength for Daily Needs, a collection of daily affirmations that was published back in 1884 and was so helpful to Marianne during her battle with cancer that she read from the book every day and kept it at her bedside until her death in September of 2009. Now, Will Schwab writes this book with so much honesty and sensitivity. Through the shared love of books and reading, we get an intimate look at a select group of titles that we should give a first or second look at. It could open new a world to us. Yet they also help mask the harsh realities of battling a usually fatal form of cancer. It's almost like having a member of our family who is enduring the cancer. And somehow we share the triumphs, setbacks, and pain that the entire Schwab family endured during Marianne's valiant battle. Now, although the title may sound quite a bit out of the ordinary and maybe a little offsetting, The End of Your Life Book Club is a powerful statement to how reading books can be so vital to your life, even if it means to help accelerate the opposite of dying.
Hmm. And you know, I said at the beginning of this, Mayans be damned, but here we are talking about the end of the world, or at least the end of a person's world, with this particular book. So let me ask you a question, Stuart.
Yeah.
If you knew you were dying by the weekend.
Yeah.
What would you want to read?
Well, that's a good question. There's so many books that I could think of offhand. It's very tough to, you know what? And don't laugh. I mean, because I like to read a lot of showbiz books and a lot of biographies and nonfiction.
Well, stop right there. Stop right there. Yeah. Because I was already going to make a choice for you, knowing you.
Yeah.
I figured you would have read one of Groucho Marx's books.
You know what? That's a good idea, actually. I would probably go for his 1959 memoir, Groucho and Me.
Yeah, I that's what I figured you'd be reading.
Yeah, no, I you're right. But also, I would also there's one book that I have that I'm looking at right now. And Alex Haley's Roots. I've always wanted to read. I've seen the TV series and always wanted to read the book, but I never got a chance to open it. So that's another one that I could have pursued if I had my own end of my life book club. But there's three books in this book that my own book club did that I enjoyed very much. The three that I recommend that are mentioned in this book are People of the Book, which is an excellent historical novel, Olive Kitteridge, which won the Pulitzer Prize, and believe it or not, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
That's very diverse, really.
Yes, it is. Very eclectic. And, you know, we did these books in my book club, and I was very curious to hear their perspectives of this, you know, because the books they chose were pretty well, I wouldn't say highbrow, but very eclectic, and especially having Girl with the Dragon Tattoo in there, maybe it was sort of like a little break from, you know, the types of books they were reading. But I recommend those three that were put in the book. And there's Chapters Indigo here, the bookstores here in Canada have special displays that they're selling the books that are mentioned in The End of Your Life Book Club, you know, at a special price.
So this book is entitled?
The End of Your Life Book Club by Will Schwab. It's published by Knopf Canada. and it's $29.95.
Now, we're not starting. I remember last year we had a trend where every book we talked about for a long period of time had some relationship to Bing Crosby.
Yeah.
It's 6 degrees of Bing we were playing. Now, we're not starting another trend here. When we do a book banter in 2 weeks, we're not going to be doing another book about books, are we?
I don't know. Maybe. You may never know.
Uh-oh. Okay. So, well, then that's something to look forward to.
Well, or maybe not. You don't know that. Don't put any pressure on me, Peter.
Okay, so once again, this book is?
It's called The End of Your Life Book Club by Will Schwab. I highly recommend it. It's one of my favorite books of 2012. It's published by Knopf Canada. It's $29.95.
Thank you very much, Stuart. We'll talk to you again in a couple of weeks. I'm now thinking, what will we be talking about then?
Well, it'll be about books, obviously.
Okay, that's a hint. And before we go, Stuart, how can people find you?
Well, you can find me in print every week in the West End Times, or you can find me online at www.westendtimes.ca. Either way, that's where I am.
Excellent. Stuart Nolman with another edition of Book Banter here with me, Peter Anthony Holder, on the Stuff File program.
The Stuff File.
And we're almost done with this edition of the Stuff File program. Just a few more Stuff File stories to get to before we get to our idiot of the day. Vermont State Police say a man faces a drunken driving charge after driving onto the lawn of a historic home once owned by the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. Police say 55-year-old Donald Blood III of Marlborough, Massachusetts, was ordered to appear in court in Bennington on January 14th. Police say Blood thought he was driving into a parking lot, but actually it was the lawn of the Wilson House, built in 1852 in Dorset, the birthplace of AA co-founder Bill Wilson. The Wilson House's website describes it as a place of sanctuary where people can come and give thanks to God for their new lives. It still hosts several AA meetings each week. Now that's what I call irony. Also, what do you think the blood alcohol level of Mr. Blood was? Just asking. Anyway, Helen Springthorpe, age 58, with only 3 months on the job as a bell ringer at St. Nicholas Church in Bathampton, England, was knocked unconscious in November when she became entangled with the bell's ropes and was jerked to and fro around the belfry, her head slamming against the wall. Firefighters and ambulance crews eventually lowered her about 20 feet to the ground. Now, do you have the visual in your head? You're trying not to laugh, aren't you? Yeah. I mean, it's like a Looney Tunes cartoon moment, isn't it? Anyway, time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Police in France said a man accused of stealing a hoard of Christmas presents from an unlocked car allegedly left his cell phone behind and reported it lost. Investigators in Rouen said the 20-year-old man, whose name was not released, allegedly stole the wrapped presents from a family's unlocked car on Christmas Eve and realized once he got home that he no longer had his phone. The man had to report the lost phone to police for his insurance company to replace it, so he visited the local police station where his victims were reporting the theft and handing the phone over to investigators. The man was arrested upon making his report, and the Christmas gifts were removed and returned to the family. Now, why, oh why, would somebody who just robbed someone of all their Christmas gifts then go to the police and report that their cell phone was missing? Well, one reason and one reason only. Okay, actually there are two. One is greed, and the other is he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0176. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0176. You can email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store store where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. While it may be an enjoyable, pleasant experience, some side effects may occur. Listening to Peter may cause bloating, drowsiness, Tourette's, web feet, or an oily discharge.